Thank you, Mr. Haney. The birth of a child is such a joyous occasion, filled with hope for the future. On the day that that child arrives, the parents and probably many others as well, grandparents, aunts and uncles, siblings oftentimes, are also filled with a great sense of anticipation. Those who are older realize that the future has come knocking on the door. And parents wonder and daydream and pray about what this little human life will become. It's an exciting time. The future often looks bright for this little one. He or she has a completely clean slate that will be written on, shaping, molding him either into a king or, sadly, maybe a cur. Built into this pure conglomeration of life as it wiggles there on the blanket will be the desire to survive, to grow, to think, to produce, to make its way in the world. We've been covering a series of sermons on the theme of raising children in a godly manner. So far, we've talked to parents, laying a foundation for teaching our children as God might desire. But today I thought I would make a pause in that trajectory, give parents a rest, talk to our young people. Parents are certainly asked to listen as well, but as we all know, raising children very quickly becomes a cooperative process. It's been said, children are like clay and can be molded. I personally don't think that's very true. Oh, they're a little bit like clay, and yes, they can be shaped a bit, but clay does not talk back. Clay doesn't move. Clay doesn't have ideas of its own. Clay doesn't develop a thinking process or something that resembles a thinking process. So it's not quite the same as molding a piece of clay. Child rearing is a cooperative process. It is a partnership between parents and children. We all know that parents direct or guide or teach, and a child responds to that direction one way or the other. Not only does that child respond to the direction of parents, but they also respond, we also respond, to all of the other influences that we come in contact with. So a child responds not just to mom and dad's direction and instruction and influence, but to all the other myriad influences that they are exposed to, all that they will come in contact with. So what I'd like to ask our young people to consider today is the subject of choices. Because all of the wonderful parenting, or on the opposite hand, all of the terrible parenting in the world, does not remove the power of choice from a young person's life. So what I would like to title today's sermon is this: Choose Wisely. Choose Wisely. I'd like to begin with a rather shocking biblical passage. If you turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 21. Yes, it's true, young people, you have choices. We strive as parents, all of us, to do the very best job that we can. We realize we have a grave responsibility before God. We feel completely responsible for you. And so we want to do our best. But we realize that we're not the only factor in this equation. You are the other factor in this equation as well. Your choices. As I mentioned, we'll start with a rather shocking set of scriptures in Deuteronomy chapter 21. We'll begin reading in verse 18. I don't read this section of scripture to threaten any of our young people, or to frighten them, or to say that they've been doing something bad. None of that is true. But it is interesting to analyze what it says. Deuteronomy 21, verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, so all the daughters are saying, phew, all right, doesn't apply to us. No, son means a child, a descendant. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they've chastened him, will not heed them. So you understand the scenario. Here's these parents, they are at their wits' end. They have tried everything to help direct the path of this son. In fact, the police are looking for him right now. And he will not respond, will not obey. Verse 19, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him, showing that he was not an adult child yet. They could take hold of him, haul him off somewhere. They take hold of him, bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gates of his city. Verse 20, and they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours, with tears no doubt, is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of this city shall stone him to death with stones. And that's shocking. And then he says, so you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. What can we learn from this tragedy? I mean, can you imagine how bad things would have to be to bring it to this point? That they would drag this child out and say, look, there's just no helping this kid. Just absolutely rebellious. What is interesting is that the elders did not inquire as to the parenting skills of mom and dad. What was the focus? They didn't say, well, no wonder the kid's a rebel. You treated him like dirt. You didn't buy him the Xbox 360 that he asked for. What's wrong with you parents? You didn't get them the laptop, the iPad, the car. Didn't ask about that. What was the focus? The behavior of the child. So these parents may have been the ideal parents. They may have loved this child. They may have directed this child. They may have cared for this child. But the child made some choices. Or they may have been the harshest of parents. They might have been mean, mean-spirited. They might have mistreated this child, denied them things, this boy, the things that he should have had. They may have been the most lenient of parents. Didn't have any rules for this child. Let him run amok. Or they may have been the most negligent of parents. Like, who cares? Yeah, it's our kid. So what? Go find your own way in the world. Doesn't say anything. None of these things were discussed. The issue was the choices that this child was making and how those choices played out in his behavior. Regardless of the parenting that this child had, the focus was on his behavior. You've heard me say before, a great philosopher once said, every tub sits on its own bottom. It's a backwoods way of saying everybody's responsible for themselves. They are responsible, not parents. You can't have people paying some psychologist $90 an hour or more and say, the reason I'm so messed up is because my dad was an idiot. Well, yes, your dad may have been an idiot, but you have made choices, and you have got to take responsibility for your life. Sadly, we feel that there always is an excuse for people. The excuse is bad choices. So I'd like today, with our young people, to take a look at the life of one young person in the Bible to see what we can learn from the choices that he made. Sadly, it happens to be a rather negative example, but very instructive. So it's worth our time and our attention to analyze it. We'll strive to list a few of the lessons we can learn from this young man's life experiences. His story begins in 2 Samuel chapter 14. 2 Samuel chapter 14. Now, it's not that he first is introduced here in this chapter, but it gives a summary of this young man here, partway into his adult, young adulthood. And it would have been quite a young adult at this point. Late teens, early 20s, possibly. This young man's story begins with a very privileged birth. He was the son of a king. 2 Samuel 14, beginning in verse 25, "But in all Israel there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty." I mean, this guy was a looker. He was the hottie of his day. If that's the proper term, I'll have to ask if that's the right term. He was the man. Someone said, you know, let's make a poster to sell to teenage girls. In Israel, 1000 AD, it would have been Absalom. And they would open their closet door and there would be Absalom, you know, flexing his muscles or whatever it might have been, standing looking with the look. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. Talk about a physical specimen. What lesson do we learn from this guy? Let's keep going. Verse 26. "When he polled his head," in other words, he cut his head, apparently cut his hair once a year, "for it was at every year end that he trimmed it. Because his hair was heavy on him, therefore he trimmed it. He was the Troy Polamalu of Israel." You know, this hair was everywhere. He could have been donating for Locks of Love year after year. Grew really fast and apparently was thick as could be. "He weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels after the king's weight." I didn't take the time to figure out how much this is, but this is some heavy hair. So Troy Polamalu had nothing on Absalom. So he looked the part. Now what is interesting is that Absalom, although looked great, what do we learn? The first thing from Absalom is this: good looks are not equivalent to godliness. Good looks are not equivalent to godliness. I remember one parent saying, you know, "I hope my child is not particularly good looking or particularly ugly, because there seems to be great pitfalls at either extreme." I thought, you know, that's not a bad thing to think. Verse 27 says, "Unto Absalom were born three sons and one daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of fair countenance." So actually named one of his children after one of his sisters in honor of her. What we learn from Absalom is a person may have natural talents, natural gifts at their disposal, but none are substitutes for converted hearts. None are a substitute for godliness. People who look good should be told every once in a while how useless that gift is and how little it means in the great scheme of life, and how those natural advantages in the carnal world are not to be seen as advantages in the spiritual world. Because every one of these people, picture Absalom in the height of his quote-unquote beauty at age 22 or 23. He was the man's man. He was the Aaron Rodgers of his day. Okay, maybe that's not the best example for those Pittsburgh Steelers fans. He was the Ben Roethlisberger. No, that's not a good example either. He was the man of his day. Picture him at 30, probably still the man. Picture him at 40. Okay, he's used to be the man, but he's being replaced by other men now. Picture him at 50. And then 60, is he still the man? Boy, he's starting to lose his hair. In fact, most of it's gone. So are most of his teeth. He's not able to do the things he used to do. How about at 70? Point is, beauty is vain. It departs so quickly. It's so empty. Has nothing to do with godliness. Turn with me, if you would, back. You might stick a finger here, or get your 3x5 card out and drop it into 1 Samuel here. We'll be back, or 2 Samuel. We'll be back in a few moments. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy 8, beginning in verse 6. What did Absalom, as he made choices in his life, not apparently seem to grasp? Well, Absalom was on his own. A sharp, intelligent fellow, but on his own. Good looks is how he got by. Not through godliness. You see, the sad thing with Absalom is he seems to have equated good looks with godliness, and that's all he needed. But because he left God out of the picture, we'll see what happens in Absalom's life. Deuteronomy 8 in verse 6. Moses says this to the Israelites, "Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Eternal your God to walk in his ways and to fear him." That was a choice Absalom should have made. Instead, Absalom was going to use his natural gifts, his abilities, to get by in life, to get ahead in life, to get position in life, and it would come crashing down all around him. Verse 7, "For the Eternal your God brings you into a land of brooks, of water, of fountains and depths that spring out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat, barley, vines, fig trees, pomegranates, land of oil, olive oil, and honey. A land wherein you shall eat bread without scarceness. You shall not lack anything in it. A land whose stones are iron, out of the hills you may dig brass." God is going to give them all these natural gifts. In this case, gifts of the land. So like Absalom, Israel as a whole was given tremendous benefits. Tremendous boost. How did they handle it? What decisions did they make? When you've eaten, verse 10, and are full, "You shall bless the Eternal your God for the good land which he gives you." You think Absalom, every year when he stood before that mirror, the razor went over his head and these locks are tumbling to the ground. You think he said, "God, thank you for giving me such healthy roots. No split ends." I'm being facetious. Do you think he thanked God for the way he looked? Do you think he asked God to help him to use that gift for the benefit of others? Not once. Because what we'll see is he tried to use those natural gifts for the benefit of himself. Bad choice. Leaving God out of the picture. Verse 11, "Beware that you forget not the Eternal your God in not keeping his commandments, his judgment statutes, which I command you this day, lest when you've eaten and are full and have built goodly houses and dwell therein, when your herds and your flocks multiply, your silver and gold is multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up." It's one of Absalom's basic problems. He was too good looking. And his Facebook page was filled with pictures of himself in one outfit and then another, holding his sword, holding his horn, holding his hair, selling it at the market, you know. His party pictures were of him. Oh, there might have been some others in there as well. But he didn't have God's direction at all. Good looks are not godliness. And here he was, vain as could be, not looking to God. He didn't think he needed God. He had everything he could possibly want. The admiration of the nation, the eyes of everyone. So verse 14, "Then your heart might be lifted up and you'll forget the Lord your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, who brought you forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness." You know the rest of the story. "Which your fathers knew not, that he might humble you, that he might prove you, that he might do good to you at the latter end. And you say in your heart, 'My power and the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth. That was Absalom. It's a description of Absalom. I'm the man. He actually began to believe it. Verse 18, but you shall remember the Eternal, your God. Good looks are not godliness. And sometimes in today's culture, good looks is more of a curse than it is a benefit. Sad, but true. Because it encourages people to leave dependence upon God. You shall remember the Eternal, your God. For it is He that gives you power to get wealth, that He may establish His covenant which He swore unto your fathers, as it is this day. Good looks are not godliness, and we want to be sure that if we have some of those quote-unquote natural gifts, that we dedicate ourselves to using those gifts for the benefit of others instead of the benefit of self. Let's go on to lesson number two. Lesson number two, control your emotions. Learn to control your emotions. Again, back to 2 Samuel, a few pages further back than where we were. 1 Samuel 13 and verse 1. We mentioned that Absalom was born with many natural gifts. He was the man of his day. The man who was the picture of manliness. He was part of a family, of course. It came to pass after this, 2 Samuel 13:1, that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar. And Amnon, another son of David, loved her. So Amnon was David's firstborn from another wife. Then Absalom and Tamar were sons and daughters of David, a son and a daughter of David, but from a different wife. So David had several wives, had children from many of these wives. So there were a number of half-siblings in the family. Amnon was the firstborn, would have been the next one on the throne. Absalom came along after him and would have been next in line for the throne. So you have Absalom and his sister Tamar. Turn down to verse 21 now. What happened? Sadly, Amnon, the oldest, fell madly in lust with his half-sister, Tamar. So much so, so little self-control did he have, such bad choices did he make, that he actually raped his half-sister. And of course, Absalom was just furious about this, as you can understand. Verse 21, but when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. And Absalom spoke unto his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad. For Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. And you can understand the anger that would be there. David spoke that anger, tried to get that out. Absalom seethed about this. He was furious. But rather than control those emotions and begin to work with them, he plotted. Notice 2 Samuel 13 down in verse 23 now. Came to pass after two full years that Absalom had sheep shears in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. Going to have everybody there. So all of his siblings, half-brothers, half-sisters, all invited to this party. It wasn't unusual to have parties like this, the time of the sheep shearing in the spring. Absalom came to the king and said, behold now, your servant has sheep shearers. Let the king, I beseech you, and his servants go with your servant. And the king said to Absalom, no, son, let us not all go, lest we be chargeable unto you. Now, we're not going to have everybody there. It'll be too expensive. But he pressed him, howbeit he would not go, but blessed him. Some feel that Absalom wanted David there at the party as well, to possibly kill him. Verse 26, then said Absalom, if not, I pray you, let my brother Amnon go with us. And the king said unto him, why should he go with you? But Absalom pressed him that he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Now, in most ancient cultures, you wouldn't have all of the heirs to the throne ever in the same spot at the same time. Because if they were fallen on by enemies, the entire kingly line could be wiped out all at once. But David allowed all the sons to go to Absalom's party. Verse 28. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, mark you now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I shall say to you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not, have I not commanded you, be courageous and valiant. So for 2 years he planned this murder. And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man got him up on his mule and fled. So there was mayhem. They all jumped on Amnon, murdered him in sight of everybody else, and everyone scatters to the four winds to try to get out of there. For 2 years, he plans this murder. Many evil things come to us as young people if we do not control our emotions. If we do not learn to hold those emotions in check, allow God's Spirit to influence those emotions, and if necessary, bring about forgiveness. Notice in verse 32. And Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, answered and said, Let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. So that very day he made a vow, I am going to kill this man. And he waited for 2 years to set it up to do so. That's evil. Now you might say, well, he did. Amnon did rape his sister. Well, that's certainly true. That was another evil. But you don't fix that evil by producing a second evil. Verse 33, now therefore, let not my lord the king take the thing to heart, to think that all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead. Bad choice. Lack of control. God says he is the one that will bring about vengeance. We don't have the authority or the right to do so. So it's important that we as young people learn to control our emotions. Start making choices. Instead of letting the emotions completely rule us, flying up, flying down based on the emotions of the moment, takes God's Spirit then to help us control those emotions, to not show vengeance. Let's turn over a page to chapter 15. Leads to another lesson. Lesson number 3. Don't be underhanded. Don't be underhanded. What do we mean by that? Let's read in 2 Samuel 15 how this was true in the young man Absalom's life. 2 Samuel 15 and verse 1. It came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. What did we said earlier about Absalom and his natural gifts? That he used them to glorify himself. And here's an expression of that. That he's going to make the grand entrance, chariots and horses and runners all announcing who's here. Absalom's in town. You kind of get the idea, like those world wrestling things. All the lights are flashing and the music's going and the smoke is pouring out and out comes the man. And he's going to show everybody what a man he is. Absalom, verse 2, rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate. And it was so that when any man that had a controversy came to the king for a judgment, then Absalom called unto him. So you understand the circumstance. Absalom is standing by the wall where all the people for court would come in and out. People who had complaints. They'd come to the king for a judgment. They had problems with all kinds of things. They'd walk past Absalom. And what would he say? He called unto them, the end of verse 2. And he said, from what city do you come? And he said, your servant is one of the tribes of Israel. In other words, maybe I came from Ephraim, or I came from Issachar, or one of the other tribes. Then Absalom said unto him, oh my, I see your matters are good and right, but there's no man deputy to the king to hear you. I feel so bad for you. I really understand your case. I understand how you've been wrong. I can see how right you are. Sadly, there's no justice here. Well, who's on the other side of the door? Well, his father, David. So what's he doing? He's undermining the king. He's underhanded here. Underhanded means you hide what your hand is doing so that people can't see it. And if we as young people develop a pattern of being underhanded with our parents, then those kinds of things will tend to carry on into our adult life as well. So he was setting things up. He was undermining his father's authority. Frankly, the authority of the kingdom. Now, the sad thing that he didn't realize is that he was undermining the system, not just his father. Of what guarantee could they possibly have if he says, look, this system is broke. If I were in charge, we'd be good. How would it be any different? I didn't stand to reason that, apparently. Verse 4. Absalom said, moreover, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which has any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice. I think I saw a TV commercial about 2 days ago with this same message. These same messages come up with every political election. Look, if I were in charge, I mean, this whole thing will be straightened out. It just is going to take me, my wisdom, my insight, and we'll fix everything. And so every 2 years, or every 4 years, or every 6 years, we hear exactly the same message. And now somehow this guy or this gal is going to fix it all. Absalom was that guy at that time. Look, if I were a judge, I would straighten this all out. You'd get justice. Verse 5, and it was so that when any man came near to him to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand and took him and kissed him. You see this scenario? Here's the king's son. We're supposed to show honor to the king's son and kneel before him. He'd grab the guy, pull him up, and give him a big bear hug. Oh, buddy, come on. We're in this together. What's he doing? He's playing these people. He was being underhanded. Verse 6, and on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He was underhanded. He was undermining his father's authority in the system as a whole. It's very important that we as young people learn to be completely open, that we learn to be completely honest, that we do not do underhanded things behind our parents' or siblings' back. It's just bad for us, and of course, bad for them as well. Unfortunately, Absalom apparently did not understand Psalm 75 in verses 6 and 7. Psalm 75 in verses 6 and 7. You see, Absalom was setting himself up. He wanted to be king. He looked the part. He spoke the part. He acted the part. He was much better king than David could ever have been. At least he thought so. Sad thing is, he was not next in line until he got rid of his older brother Amnon. So now he begins setting it up. Instead of waiting for God's promotion, he was going to get his own through an underhanded method. Psalm 75, verses 6 and 7. David understood this. He wrote, for promotion comes neither from east nor from west nor from the south. But God is the judge. He puts down one and sets up another. Instead of underhandedly striving to steal the throne from his father, he should have simply waited. And if his heart was right, if his attitude was right, he would have been given the throne at the appropriate time. A young person will be given independence at the appropriate time. It will always, almost, be later than the child thinks it should, and almost always feel earlier than a parent thinks it should. But that time will always come when you'll have full and total responsibility for your own life. Don't go about trying to do it in an underhanded way now. Point number four, don't be sneaky. Now you might say, well, that's just like being underhanded. No, there's a subtle difference here. Sneakiness has to do with deception. Underhanded is just doing wrong things, trying not to be caught, trying not to be found out. Sneaky deals with deception. Notice how that played out in Absalom's life. 2 Samuel chapter 15 in verse 7. We just read in verse 6 how through his underhandedness he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. They began to be more and more discontented with David because of what Absalom was feeding them. 2 Samuel 15, verse 7, it came to pass after 4 years that Absalom said to the king, I pray you, let me go now, pay my vow, which I vowed to the Eternal in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I abode at Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I'll serve the Eternal. What's this all about? See, he's setting them up. Absalom, through his underhandedness, had set up Israel enough that he now knew that he had a large enough following that he could take it to the next level. So now he just outright lies to David. And he says, you know, I made this vow years ago that if God spared me, I'd go back and I'd give this sacrifice. So I want to go back to Hebron and make this sacrifice. Well, interesting. Remember where David was crowned king? It was in Hebron. Later on, he came and was recrowned by all of Israel in Jerusalem. But he was initially crowned king in Hebron. So what was Absalom setting up through sneaky deception? Through lying? And deception, trust me, is lying. People say, well, I didn't say something false. I just didn't say everything, and I let the person assume something. Now, if they assume something that wasn't true, it's not my fault. Oh, yes, it is. If you had the intent to deceive, that is lying. That's a breaking of the commandment. When I try to deceive someone, if I'm sneaky, it's a lie. I'm intentionally trying to get that person to believe something that's not true. That's a lie. So verse 9, the king said to him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. Was it for the purpose of the sacrifice? No. Verse 10, Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say Absalom reigns in Hebron. He went to set up himself as king. So Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called. And they went in their simplicity. They knew not anything. So these 200 simply were soldiers. They were drawn along. They didn't even know what was going on. They were part of the conspiracy and didn't even know it. He was being sneaky. He deceived them as well. How do you plan to be successful before God when deception, commandment breaking is in the middle of it? Verse 12. Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city, even from Gilo. While he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. One of David's closest counselors was a part of the conspiracy through deception. Again, do we expect God to bless that? This is God's nation. You think God's going to bless that? Incredible. Verse 13, there came a messenger to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom. He had deceived them. Notice over in chapter 16, 2 Samuel 16 and verse 1, deceptive people gather deceptive people. if I gain your confidence by deceiving someone else, and I include you in that deception, are you encouraged to be a completely open and honest person, or are you a deceiver as well? You see, deceivers attract deceivers. 2 Samuel 16, verse 1, when David was a little past the top of the hill, he had to flee for his life. Behold, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, and upon them 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 of summer fruits, and a bottle of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "What mean you by this?" And Ziba said, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, and the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine as such as may be faint you to drink in the wilderness." And the king said, "Where is your master's son?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he abides at Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today shall the house of Israel be restored to me, the kingdom of my father.'" So now, instead of Absalom only making the claim, now one of Saul's descendants is also making the claim to the throne. Verse 4, then said the king to Ziba, "Behold, yours are all that pertains to Mephibosheth." And Ziba said, "I humbly beseech you that I may find grace in your sight, O eternal king," or "Lord king, my lord, O king." So what happens here? David begins to attract honest men, and dishonest men are attracted to Absalom. So it's rather sad to see that taking place. Let's go on to point number 5. Practice patience. Practice patience. Let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 3. 2 Samuel chapter 3. What do we learn from Absalom? Absalom would likely have received all of the power and prestige of the kingship if he had just been patient and waited. Being patient and waiting is often not a gift of youth, especially in today's immediate society. Practicing patience can be a very difficult thing. Absalom probably would have been king if he had been patient and waited. Notice 2 Samuel chapter 3, beginning in verse 2. Unto David were sons born in Hebron, and his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. We already talked about Amnon. The second, Chileab of Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And third was Absalom. Now, what is interesting about this is that Absalom was third in line to receive the throne. We know what happened to Amnon. He was murdered by Absalom. But what happened to Chileab? You know, there's no record of what happened. Did he die early? He was, after Amnon, second in line for the throne. Absalom would have been third. Had Absalom showed patience, and was he designed to be the king, he would have been named the king. What is interesting is that none of these sons of David, born early in his life, ended up becoming king. Who did? The last born son, Solomon. God designed that. You see, God is in charge. So we practice patience to wait for God's direction to be obvious. We wait. As we said, oftentimes, youth and patience do not necessarily go together. Now, that's not to say that being old and patience go together either. But it's often a curse of youth, is that we can't wait long enough for God's will to become obvious. Let's go on to our next lesson, number 6. Respect God's choices. Respect God's choices. Turn a few pages ahead to 2 Samuel 17. We'll pick up the story where we left off in the middle of the rebellion against his father. 2 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 1. Remember, Ahithophel is mentioned here in the beginning of verse 1, was one of David's most trusted counselors. Probably one of the wisest and most incisive minds of the day. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night." The conspiracy had grown so strong that David and his few loyal people fled Jerusalem into the wilderness. And Ahithophel says, "You take 12,000 men tonight. You chase him down. You can kill him and everybody with him, and it'll be all over." And you know what? That was outstanding advice for carnal, slovenly creeps. And it would have worked. Would have been 100%. "I will come upon him while he's weary and weak-handed." I mean, everyone was still in shock over what had happened. Absalom had taken over. And no one knew really what was going on. "I will come upon him while he's weary and weak-handed, and I will make him afraid. And all the people that are with him shall flee, and I will smite the king only. And I'll bring back all the people to you. The man whom you seek is as if all returned. So all the people shall be in peace." It will all be over. The saying pleased Absalom well, and all the elders of Israel. Wow, what great advice. What is interesting is that David's approach was exactly the opposite. Turn back to an earlier time in David's life, 1 Samuel chapter 24. Who did God place on the throne? 1 Samuel chapter 24. God placed David on the throne. Who was about to try to take David off the throne? Well, not God, but Absalom and his co-conspirators. How had David handled this situation? Very similar situation a generation before. When Saul was the king that had been placed on the throne by God, there were far greater problems in Israel, much greater injustice. In fact, the king himself was flirting with witches and demons and trying to get information from familiar spirits. I mean, it was a mess. But how did David deal with that? Did he respect God's choices? 1 Samuel 24 and verse 6. He could have killed Saul, but he said, verse 6, he said to his men, "God forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." So not only did David not kill the king, he commanded his soldiers to leave the king alone as well. You see, in that day and age in Israel, God selected the king, placed him on the throne, and until God took him off the throne, it would be improper not to respect God's choices. God left those people on the throne for a particular purpose. Absalom would not respect God's choices. Whose home has God placed you in? He placed you in a home with a mother and a father, at least in most cases. Grandmother or grandfather in some cases. But we have the responsibility to respect God's choices until the time that we're on our own. Now, we still respect God's choices, but we're not directly under their authority in quite the same way that we were when we were in their charge. Which leads us to our final point. And that is, honor your parents. Honor your parents. That is a lifelong responsibility and obligation. Sometimes it can be very difficult. If you turn back to the commandment in Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. It is very clear that we are to honor our parents, period. Exodus 20 and verse 12. This was at times a challenge for me as a young person. Especially challenging when I didn't agree with my parents. Didn't think my parents were too smart. Didn't think they made very good decisions. Especially regarding me and the things about my life. Especially when I felt they didn't grasp what a fine and mature young man I obviously was, and they just didn't get it. That I could make perfectly good decisions at age 14 or 15 or 16 because I was pretty smart. I don't understand why they didn't get it. Exodus 20 and verse 12, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the eternal your God gives you. Pretty clear commandment. Honor father and mother. Now, we could very easily say that honor equals obedience. It just does. I can't say I'm honoring my father and mother if they ask me to do something and I don't do it. Or I give them a hassle about it. Honor means that we have a certain respect toward them and that we're obedient. So if we hope to set ourselves up for a lifetime of good and right, God says to learn from the beginning to honor parents. Turn again back to 2 Samuel chapter 17. 2 Samuel chapter 17. Could we say that Absalom honored his father? I think we can pretty safely say he did not. He considered himself smarter than his father. He considered himself better looking than his father. And you know what? Both of those things were probably true. What he didn't understand is that he was not in a relationship with God like his father was. So he didn't honor his father. Now, God made sure that that would come back upon Absalom. So you remember where we left off in 2 Samuel 17. Ahithophel gives outstanding military advice and says, while they're all in disarray, send this powerful army. It will scatter everyone. We'll kill David. And the people will have no choice but to support you. Everything will be over. But there was something in the back of Absalom's mind that said, you know, we better get another opinion. So, in verse 5, Absalom said, call now Hushai the Archite, and let us likewise hear what he says. Give him the same facts. Let him give information. Now, Hushai was loyal to David. And he understood that Ahithophel's insight was precise. And if that insight were followed, David would likely be destroyed. So verse 6, when Hushai was come to Absalom, Absalom spoke unto him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken after this manner. So shall we do after his saying? Shall we do what he says? If not, speak. And Hushai said to Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. For, said Hushai, you know your father and his men, that they be mighty men, and that they be chafed in their minds, as a bear robbed of her whelps in the field. And your father is a man of war, and will not lodge with the people. Behold, he's hid now in some pit, or in some other place. And it will come to pass, when some of them be overthrown at the first, that whosoever hears it will say, there's a slaughter among the people that follow Absalom. And he also is valiant, whose heart is as the heart of a lion, shall utterly melt. For all Israel knows your father is a mighty man, and they which are with him are valiant men. So the first couple soldiers that get killed in your army are going to run like babies in front of these experienced men of war. Therefore, I counsel that all Israel be generally gathered unto you, from Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand that's by the sea for multitude, and that you go into battle in your own person. In other words, take some time, gather a bigger army, and then you, Absalom, you the man, you lead this group into battle. Verse 12, so shall we come upon him in some place where he shall be found, and we will light upon him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men that are with him there shall not be so much as one left. Moreover, if he's gotten into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, will draw it into the river until there be not one small stone left there. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord has appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. You see, you mistake good looks for godliness. You don't control your emotions. You act in an underhanded way. You're deceptive and sneaky. You're impatient. You don't respect God's choices. You don't honor your father and mother. You will die. It's a lesson from Absalom. God saw to it that everybody agreed that Hushai's advice was better. God worked that out. Now, we won't take the time to read through the rest of the story, but what did Ahithophel go and do as a result? When he saw that his counsel was not going to be followed, he knew that David would win, that Absalom would die. So he went and committed suicide because he knew he was as good as dead for speaking against the king. This was treason. And when the king came back, and he knew he would, they had one shot at defeating David. And that was immediately after he was chased out of Jerusalem. When they lost that shot, it was over. So he realized. So we're to honor our parents. And I would mention to all of us, certainly as parents, but especially to our young people, that it's interesting how parents feel responsible for you and your choices. We do. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 12. Even though Absalom was a rebel, very good-looking rebel, but a rebel nonetheless, disobedient, underhanded, deceptive, impatient, disrespectful, David felt responsible. 2 Samuel chapter 9, I'm sorry, 12 and verse 9. 2 Samuel 12 and verse 9. David felt responsible for the way Absalom turned out. What we look at here is an incident in David's life where he made as a parent, before he was a parent, possibly, or maybe in his early parenting years, made a terrible mistake. Committed adultery, had a man murdered. God gives David a judgment, a sentence. Wherefore, he says, you have despised the commandment of the Eternal to do evil in his sight. Why have you done that? You've killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You've taken his wife to be your wife. You've slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you've despised me and taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. David felt that Absalom's misbehavior was at least in part his fault. Now, none of the parents that I'm familiar with have ever done anything like this. But because they are people with God's Spirit, at times they feel guilty. When you, as a young person, misbehave, when you are underhanded or sneaky or impatient or disrespectful, we as parents feel like somehow this partly must be my fault. I must have done something. Now, we don't go back in our history and see any Bathsheba or Uriah, but parents look back and say, something I must have done wasn't right. Well, none of us as parents are perfect. And as we began, we understood that parents, in their responsibility, were not on trial when children were brought before the elders. Because now it's their life. It's their choice. 2 Samuel 18. 2 Samuel 18. In spite of Absalom's absolutely foul behavior, his rebellious conspiracy, his arrogance, 2 Samuel 18. David numbered the people that were with him in verse 1, set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. You see, David immediately organized his armies. David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab, a third under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I will surely go forth with you myself. But the people answered, you shall not go forth, for if we flee away, they'll not care for us. Neither if half of us die, they will care for us. But now you are worth 10,000. Therefore, it's better that you help us out of the city, so you stay back. The king said, whatever seems best to you. The king stood by the gates, and all the people came by hundreds and thousands, went out to war. The king commanded, verse 5, Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with a young man, even Absalom. You see, regardless of our children's behavior, we love them and we feel responsible for them. Now, was David responsible for Absalom's behavior? Absolutely not. But he couldn't shake the fact that he felt that he was. And we as parents have the same feelings, that when our children are successful, we as parents say, I don't know how it happened. It wasn't because of us. And when our children make horrible mistakes, we say, man, I must have done something terrible. Or they wouldn't have made that choice. And none of those things are true necessarily, neither one of them. David couldn't shake the fact that he felt responsible. Now, you know the story, end of chapter 18, what happens? Absalom, being arrogant, being rude, being uncontrolled in his emotions, being underhanded, being deceptive, impatient, disrespectful, completely underestimated his father's armies, and ended up dead. He, ironically, tried to escape on his donkey, got caught in a tree by all of his golden locks, and there he was, hanging in the tree by his hair, the hair that he'd brag about so often, that he thought was so great, that made him so desirable to so many people. Ironically, God hung him by his hair. Joab came by and put an arrow right through his heart, and he died there, hanging in the tree. Tragic end to a life that had so much promise, that could have been so wonderful. Notice end of chapter 18, verse 32. Verse 31 says, behold, Cushai came, and Cushai said, tidings, my lord the king, for the Eternal has avenged you this day of all them that rose up against you. Cushai knew that in spite of Absalom's behavior, how David felt about him. We said before, there are a few things that can pull us through a knothole backwards, like our kids. Cushai was being gentle. All the enemies that rose up against the king has God avenged. What was he saying? He was saying Absalom is dead without having to say it. The king said to Cushai, is the young man Absalom safe? Had David not been a man with God's spirit, he would have been asking this in the opposite. Are you sure that rebel is dead? That's what he would have asked. But because God's spirit was there, and because he felt partly responsible, is the young man Absalom safe? Is how he asked it. And Cushai answered, the enemies of my lord the king and all that rise against you to do you hurt, be as that young man is. And the king was much moved, went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God that I had died for you, O Absalom, my son. What a sad ending. David felt somehow responsible. Young people, parents will not be perfect. They will make mistakes with you. Maybe they already have. They'll make mistakes in judgments about you. They may impute motives to you that you didn't intend. They may suspect you of things you didn't do. But for each one of those, there are probably things you did do that they didn't catch. At least if you were like me, there were plenty of things that I probably should have been called on the carpet for that were never found out. So parents will make mistakes. It's hard for them to forgive themselves. But when you show honor to them, in spite of their imperfection, they'll do likewise to you. They'll love you and show honor always. And they do, even when they have to, even when they have to go through some very difficult circumstances with you in guidance of your life. It's a challenge. So we have choices. We would encourage you to make right choices, understanding that good looks are not godliness, that emotions are something to be controlled, that we must be open and above board, not underhanded. Never practice deception. It will always come back to bite us in the long run. Practice patience. Parents will not be perfect. Respect God's choices and honor your parents. We'll find if we do these things, we'll be able to learn from the example of Absalom and make sure that our life, rather than ending in tragedy and heartache, can be a life of joy and peace and family prosperity, because that's certainly what God desires. So let's do our part to make wise choices.
All right, brethren, we'll sing one more hymn here at the close of services, after which we will be led in closing prayer by Mr. Charlie Bond. So if you would all rise then and take your hymnals, we'll sing hymn 124, Praise the Lord.